Watergate 50 contains language at times which may not be suitable for everyone, and just be aware, this is episode 8 of the series. If you have missed any of it so far, please go check out thecopelandroad.org or heartandhand.co.uk. Look for Watergate 50 and get all caught up.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
After a brief hearing inside, Mr. Jaworski reemerged to loud cheers this time, since the word had spread quickly that the justices had reached a unanimous decision, an 8-0 decision against Mr. Nixon, written by the Chief Justice himself. The decision was full of legal argument, but it came down to this. Yes, the president does have some rights to executive privilege, that is, to keep some secrets in the White House. But he must lose that right if the evidence is indeed needed in a trial, as the 64 tapes are.
The way to handle this now is for us to have Walters call Pat Gray and just say, stay the hell out of this.
Do you remember your President Nixon?
We have a cancer within close to the presidency that's growing. It's growing daily.
The Democratic National Committee is located in the Watergate office building. The burglars forced a stairwell door, then taped its latch open.
What really hurts in matters of this sort is not the fact that they occur, because overzealous people in campaigns do things that are wrong. What really hurts is if you try to cover it up.
Because only if you've been in the deepest valley can you ever know how magnificent it is to be on the highest mountain. Just like you and
all night, what the young America.
Young America.
All right, welcome back to Watergate at 50, the Crow Pod Heart and Hand crossover now, episode 8. And David, we are into the death spiral of the Nixon White House here. Well into it.
Yes, we are. And it's amazing how simultaneously long it took and how quickly it went.
I mean, we've even taken breaks and it still feels like it's flown by.
I mean, it's really this very slow burn for 2 years. But like,
you know,
they
should make a podcast called that.
They should make it's a great name for a podcast. But once they, it's not as good as this one. But once they, you know, once the pieces began to fall, kind of like a roof collapsing, isn't it? First, there's a couple of drips, and then maybe a bit of tile drops, and then all of a sudden,
like an engineering cascading failure.
and that's exactly what we have here with this particular thing, and it is amazing in a way that he survived from October and the Saturday Night Massacre through till June. These days, Shane, maybe not so much in a 24-hour news cycle, but even so, I think then as well the burden of proof was higher to actually think bad of, or to certainly think the worst of a president. People didn't like him, that was fair enough, but to think that a president could do something illegal, I think we're much more prepared to believe that people in any high office in any country are capable of misdeeds now.
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, something that we've talked about repeatedly and something we're going to talk about with one of the people that we're going to go back and look at a little bit today is, well, I mean, just the commitment the commitment that people threw out and all the different investigatory bodies and from the media through the Irvin Committee, through the two versions of the Special Prosecutor's Office, the House Judiciary Committee, everybody else, it was never a rush to get to the conclusion. It was, what is the right conclusion?
That's a good point.
I obviously, like last week, how much we had to talk about this. I mean, they didn't even know how to do an impeachment, and instead of rewriting the rules or what they thought the rule should be on the fly, they went, well, let's kind of go back and, maybe take a look at how they tried to do this back in 1868. And let's see if we can find some legal text or something to kind of steer us in the correct direction. So, it could have become. I mean, one of the key things, one of the reasons that this could play out was that the Democrats had control of both houses of Congress, and without that, none of this ever would have taken place. I mean, you could talk about, whatever kind of morals the Republicans found during this time. But, starting in, January of 73, had they had control of either the Senate or the House, this wouldn't have ever happened.
Look at the Wright Patman investigation that we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, and it's exactly the same thing. That even though, as you say, that the houses were ideally set, there was still this wild reluctance. But evidence began to mount up and mount up. And of course, we're going to talk about, we've already mentioned guys like Wiggins, Charles Wiggins, who defended them to the last. I mean, he defended them until it became impossible. That's maybe a difference now that we see people defending what we know they believe is indefensible. Because it's a tactical thing, and they understand that they'll get a reward for it down the line, be it from a party, be it from an electorate. I don't think that's the case here. I think when people were faced, because it goes back to something we said right at the start, that there were enough people who kept open minds, who kept saying, I think this, however, if the evidence points me in a different direction, I'm willing to go there. And that's, of course, the real positive thing that comes out of this.
Well, I mean, one of those guys, again, somebody that we kind of glossed over, but somebody that we need to go back and spend a little bit of time on here is Leon Jaworski, the second special prosecutor. And I think, David, I mean, it was one of the hard things with the show, even as we tried to construct them, or, I guess even as I tried to keep the timeline put together. But it's so hard to keep like a linear timeline because of all the different bodies investigating this stuff, of all the different people who come in and go. I mean, look, right now we're getting into the last couple weeks in Nixon's presidency here. That's where we left you on episode 7 there about the Judiciary Committee. And there is still the Sam Irvin Committee working, right? They're not done. They're done with the investigations and the TV shit and all that kind of stuff, the stuff that looked good, but they're still working. And obviously, again, the Special Prosecutor's Office has been working this entire time. And the guy, the guy who's doing that, again, we gave a whole episode to Archibald Cox, deservedly so. I mean, just absolutely. What a damn character. but instead we get, his replacement, I think Bork, with Nixon's, approval and whatnot, kind of went down this road. Leon Jaworski is, he's not a Republican, he's a Democrat, but he's, again, a theme that we've talked about repeatedly on the show, a Southern Democrat. And he voted for Nixon twice. He was the treasurer of the Reagan, Democrats for Reagan, part of his campaign in 1980. He was not Cox by any measure. No. But he was a man of great principle, a guy, he's appointed there 10 days after the massacre, which, like David said, I mean, under any normal circumstances, should have seen the end of Nixon's presidency. But I think I think they're still part of the shell shock of everything that's going on. And again, the fact that you don't know how to reach the outcome of this. I think at that point, everybody knew what it should be, but you still have to do it the right way. Yeah. And that's very much Jaworski's, I mean, his background in all this and how he comes into this spot in the first place.
Yeah, he was a constitutional law expert, very successful lawyer. In fact, had been considered for the Nixon defense team. And like a lot of really senior lawyers who had no personal relationship to Nixon, didn't want that job because they understood, as we know happened, as we've heard from Garment, that Nixon basically wouldn't let them do their job properly. Yeah. He wouldn't allow them. That
sounds like somebody we know today.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with incredibly powerful people. It's the problem with all successful people is that they think they're successful and they think it's because they've got special skills, which they do, clearly, but they think it makes them an expert on a lot of things. And, you know, Nixon wouldn't take his lawyer's advice, wouldn't allow them to do things, set constraints upon them, and really hindered them going into battle. And I think that, you know, if you didn't need it, you didn't need the hassle. And also Jaworski was at a stage in his life, he was successful, as you mentioned, Shane, he didn't need the hassle. But like Cox, in a certain way, he took the job not because he thought, great, loads of attention. He took the job because he figured it needed doing. Somebody had to do it.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, he was a defense attorney. Coming out of school, Jaworski's first gig was like defending bootleggers during Prohibition, which again, he took as, well, one, it made him a lot of money, but two, he took it on the principled stance of, like, these people shouldn't be losing their damn lives over running. Everybody's buying, the politicians are buying it. Yeah. You know, why should these people be going to jail? And of course, you know, he goes to work there at what ends up becoming Fulbright and Jaworski, one of the largest law firms in the country by the time he dies. Again, like so many people throughout the story, serves during World War II. He's actually in the judge advocate's office, turns down the Nuremberg trials after prosecuting successfully a number of war crimes cases, turns down the Nuremberg trials. Again, here comes the principles, because the laws that they were trying to prosecute these men for didn't exist when they committed the crimes. Mm. And on his basis and his principles, you couldn't do that. Of course, a big character and somebody, again, like I said, it's hard to keep these timelines linear, but Bud Crow, who, well, he was in charge of the plumbers, right? I mean, I don't think there's any other way to put it there.
Wait, no, he was given the task by Haldeman and Ehrlichman to be in charge of the plumbers. Now, did Gordon Liddy run wild? Yes, but did he know taking that job that they were going to be engaged in illegal activities? Yes, he did. What I will say for Bud Crow is he's one of the very few who, even at the time, said, no, I did this and I deserve to be punished for doing this. You know, and he's been very upfront. He's not Dean. He's never tried to retell the story to suit him.
No. Well, and Crow, you know, Jaworski, he's the first guilty verdict that Jaworski gets. It's the first one the special prosecutor's office gets in general, because Crow does just, he turns up. Yeah, I mean, look, Bud Crow, again, he was in charge of the plumbers. If you remember back to episode two, we talked at great length about these. He was the one who'd approved breaking into to Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. He ends up getting fired, ironically, again, principles here at some point. He gets fired out of the Nixon White House for refusing to wiretap. I forget who it was that they wanted him to wiretap. But he said, no, I'm not doing that. That's, no, you're crazy. Like, I shouldn't have done this thing where I broke into that guy's office, but I'm definitely not doing that shit. And so, I mean, he hands himself in, right? Once Jaworski comes in, hands himself in, takes his guilty plea, but, he's trying to get readmitted to the bar, right? He goes to jail. He serves his time, right? Like a few of these guys, he just said, you know what? Fuck it. I did it. Send me to jail because I'm going there no matter what, you know?
Let's get it.
And he tries to come back afterwards. 1980, he resubmits an application because, I mean, he gets disbarred. He was a lawyer.
Of course.
So they punt him, you know? And he tries to get readmitted to the bar in Washington, and it's Leon Jaworski who comes in to support his application, saying that, you know, he'd shown actual integrity. Well, remorse, first of all, which was severely lacking in many of these people, chief among them, Liddy. But, But you know that he'd actually shown some integrity in turning himself in and giving himself up again. I mean, Jaworski was not
not foaming at the mouth. And when he went in to the team, because it was the same team, it was the Cox team, very loyal to Cox, and understandably so, and deservedly so, and you know what you need. But they felt that they were kind of different politically, different age, you know, different part of the country. And you know, Shane, you'll know that better than us, America is a country that is very much divided by geography. It is very much a place that, you know, it's so big, you know, it's got time zones, for Christ's sake. So you know, you do have these enormous differences. But he slowly won them over when they realized that, hang on, he's not a plant, he's not here to finish us and to tidy us up. But what he did do, as Shane says, is ruminate a lot on the how, right? He listened to some of the tapes when he arrived, and he's guilty, right? And he knew that it only ended one way. But how do you do it? This is the thing. Well, there is no process for this.
No, and I think, you know, I mean, he kind of, well, here's part of his very first press conference. This is on, again, going back, this is November 9th of 73 here. So we're 10 days out from the massacre, and this is Jaworski's first press conference here.
In this regard, I wish to emphasize that the acting attorney general has issued regulations defining my authority and jurisdiction in precisely the same terms as were used in defining those of Professor Cox, with what I think is a notable and significant addition of a firm and formal assurance that the president has agreed not to exercise his constitutional power to affect my discharge, except in accordance with the consensus of the bipartisan leadership of the House and the Senate and of the judiciary committees of both houses. In particular, prior to acceptance, I was given unqualified assurance that there would be absolutely no constraints on my freedom to seek any and all evidence, wherever it may be, including the presidential files, and to invoke the judicial process should I consider it necessary.
Right there, obviously, this is what killed Cox. And despite the fact Cox having assurances from Elliot Richardson that this would not happen, which, of course, this is how we get to the massacre, because Richardson said, no, you made me go in front of the Senate and tell these people I would let this guy do this job when we appointed him. And now, well, now you're saying they can't. Nixon, you know, it's one of these, why didn't he destroy the tapes, right? Why did he commit so hard to letting Jaworski do what he wouldn't let Cox do? And, you know, it's, again, without his closest advisors around him, even back in the fall of 73, as he's starting to come apart, starting to drink more, starting to, you know, just he's not the same Dick Nixon he was in 1972. And he concedes this point to Bork, who, not an ideologue by any means, in terms of justice for the law. I mean, Bork has always been a far right wing zealot. And proved it, you know, even in his time in the Nixon White House. But he knew if he wanted any furtherance of a career, he would have to toe this line that Richardson tried to. And, you know, this is how you end up with Jaworski. I mean, a Southern Democrat, but he's a very conservative guy, very conservative ideals, ex-military man, somebody that Nixon maybe thought somewhere in there might not lay on him as hard as Archibald Cox had.
Absolutely.
That's not the case.
Absolutely no doubt that Nixon thought that he was getting somebody who was more simpatico to him. However, I do wonder if it had to be someone like this, because there would always have been the taint around Cox of he was JFK Solicitor General and an admitted and long-term Nixon hater. And that does colour it. It gives you room for manoeuvre if you're the other side, where you can say, witch hunt. You couldn't say witch hunt with Jaworski. It just wasn't it wasn't credible. And on the change in circumstances, that's why the massacre is so important, because it changes everything. Afterwards, things that Nixon thought he could do, he now knows he can't. And it really is it moves on now from being a fight about the tapes into an obfuscation of the tapes. It moves into, can we cloud this? Can we? There's a great line in Blackadder where he says, fighting a duel, he says, right, when he says choose your sword, you kick him in the nuts, I'll set fire to the building, and in the confusion we claim a draw. And that's exactly what Nixon moves to. He realizes now, I cannot win this. But he moves to, because there's a time on it, Shane, isn't there? He's got 2 years, you know, at 74. Yeah. He is going to leave the White House anyway. He's a second termer. He doesn't need to worry. Can I keep this going long enough? Can I do things? Can I dial it down? Can I get the temperature down?
Oh, he's parking the bus.
but what he doesn't ever realize is you can't get the temperature down now. You know, the pot has boiled and it's now just a case of getting to a certain level. But you're right. I still tend to agree with Len Garment here that destroying the tape, one, it would have finished them, you know, it would have finished them publicly. Because nobody believes you're doing it for principle, right? He's not. No. I mean, they're accurate in that belief.
Well, he very easily could have just pulled you can't hear anything on these, you know? And honestly, they could have just dug out one tape. Because again, we've said it repeatedly, you can't hear anything on a lot of these tapes. And they could have produced one and been like, yeah, you know, this is what they all sound like. Sorry, the system didn't work. And people probably would have believed it.
Yeah, I mean, he could have done that, but by this stage, you can't, you know.
No, this stage, no. People have heard some of them.
People have heard some of them, yeah. So by this stage of the game, he really can't. And I do tend to think that destroying them right about now would be, even the ones that weren't subpoenaed yet, I think you're getting into to very dangerous ground. But it would have finished them publicly because people would have People were beginning now, even, you know, unless they were absolutely staunch defenders of them. People were now saying, look, he could make. He says he wants this to go away. If those tapes clear him, why don't he just release the tapes that clear him and we get done with this? Because it would have. And, you know, people aren't stupid. If it walks like a duck, etc. and people are beginning to fit. But he's determined to assert his constitutional right, which he has the same as everyone else, to go to court and to take this battle to court and argue in front of the highest court in the land if need be. He's quite prepared to do that. And again, he believes, Shane, that it'll take so long to get through the Supreme Court. You know, it's not quite, because it's not easy to get into the Supreme Court quickly, right? Something that's important. They take their while. This is almost unprecedented, the speed at which the Supreme Court move on this.
Well, I mean, this is Jaworski's, you know, we go back to the Stennis compromise, which preceded the massacre, right? That was the first Nixon compromise. And when Jaworski comes in again, the White House hands over, what was it? Eight tapes, I think.
Eight.
But one of them is one where he's talking to Dean about, you know, when Dean asks him, or I think we need $1 million over the next 2 years. And Nixon goes, well, that could be found. Right. And Jaworski hears this and immediately knows, okay, well, that's a crime from the president. So let's start working with it. You know, and this is where him and the team, you know, Cox's team really start gelling. He goes back and he wants, there's 64 more of these conversations that he wants. Well, he subpoenas the White House for. And this is what sets off this court battle. Now, again, there's another court battle going on. We're going to get back to it here in a little bit with John J. Sirica, that old chestnut, because he's the one handling the case for the House Judiciary Committee. But Jaworski, as David said, you know, to get a case directly to the Supreme Court, it doesn't happen. I mean, there's a system by which court cases flow in this country, and they flow upward toward it. And getting something to the court that quick, you kind of have to be in a special position. And so, you know, Jaworski asked for these 64 tapes, and this is where Nixon comes out with his the big binders full of information, right? thinking again that this would settle it. But as we find out, Even after Nixon releases these, and even after everybody starts looking at him and laughing at him and expletive deleted and everything else, and even though at this point the Judiciary Committee has parts of those tapes and tells the special prosecutor's office, look, this is not what they say, setting all that aside, they only covered 28 of the 64 tapes that Jaworski wanted, which was never going to be enough. Nope. And just like Cox, he also thought, rightfully so, a defendant doesn't get to choose what evidence they provide. You know, that's not.
It would be really handy.
How our system works.
No, and look, it's a shame. I, for one, certainly would be committing more crimes if the...
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and I'll be quite upfront with you all there, folks. I would be
Your
committing...
Honor, I would like the video showing me murdering the man, removed from evidence, also yes. weapon.
Yes.
All the eyewitness statement. And actually, the eyewitnesses. Can we just kill the eyewitnesses also?
These are prejudicial to my case.
My case.
As Shane said, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your point of view on how the justice system works, you aren't allowed to select what you're going to have to defend. And look, at this stage now, Jaworski has heard the tapes and has made up his mind. He knows now. He knows that it's now not a matter of is this man guilty. And again, I think something to remember about Jaworski. Jaworski wasn't of the opinion I need to ruin Richard Nixon. I need to have his head on a pike. That wasn't the motivation. But
in fact, he was quite the opposite.
Yeah, but it was. We need to get this man out of the White House.
Yeah. Well, and this is, so in the crux of this is where you get the Watergate 7, the seven close Nixon aides who end up going up river. Nixon, though, is still fighting this. And this is the grand jury where, Jaworski decides he's not going to indict the president no matter what, which is how the Judiciary Committee ends up with this pile of evidence. But Nixon still has to fight all these tapes to keep them out of Jaworski's hands and also out of the House's hands, right? Because amongst these are the smoking gun tape, right?
Yes.
And that's it. I mean, that one, had that one tape right there come out, in January 1973, we could have avoided all this because it would have just been done.
Yes.
Yeah, that's it. So, of course, Nixon, again, in a common thread, he appeals this thing on two fronts, right? He said, special prosecutor does not have the right to sue the office of the president, which Jaworski disagreed with. Again, he didn't think he could indict Nixon as a sitting president on crimes, but that's different than suing the office of the president. And again, this is Nixon's trick, and we're going to come to Alexander Haig here in a little bit, of parsing the difference between Richard Nixon himself and the office of the presidency, right? Mm. But second, that all these materials were privileged conversation, that this is the old executive privilege one. Jaworski sees this, right, and knows what tack the Nixon White House is going to take, and this is why he says, fuck this. We're in district court already. I'm skipping the Court of Appeals. We're going straight to the Supreme Court. And SCOTUS takes it up because they recognize as well as anybody. Look, even if this goes through the Court of Appeals, as David said, all he's trying to do is draw this thing out as long as he can.
Yeah.
And they go, Leon, bring it right on in the front door here. Just bring it on. We'll go ahead and take a look at that.
It's a huge blow for Nixon because, as Shane mentioned there, he is trying to draw it out. He wants it to last as long as possible. And the Supreme Court do recognize it's coming here because no decision is going to be acceptable to one side. They're going to keep going until they get the final ruling on it. And they decide, I think correctly, let's not draw this out. Let's bring this straight in here. This is where it's coming anyway. Let's save the time and resource and bring it here. And they agree to take it. And Nixon had been, their annual shutdown had been coming. And Nixon thought, well, that buys me a few months.
Yeah.
And then they say, no, we'll hear it before that. And that, of course, then speeds everything up dramatically.
Yeah, and so, again, this goes before SCOTUS, and you got James St. Clair there representing the president amongst a pile of lawyers at this time. I can't even keep up with all Nixon's attorneys because, much like Trump, they keep coming and going, although for different reasons. Trump doesn't pay his people. Nixon just thought he was right.
He wouldn't let them do the... Yeah.
No,
this is why, in the end up, it becomes, there's Len Garment, who is... an old friend who worked in the White House, was a Democrat actually, but was a liberal, but had worked with Nixon, and I think was more capable because of his prior relationship to Richard Nixon, not President Nixon, was more capable of telling him things he didn't want to hear. And I think Nixon would have been better suited from word one, day one, had he brought in Garment and listened to him, because Garment would have told him, you know, fess up on it, deal with the guys who have done wrong, and he would have come through it. You know, that's the thing. So Garment is staying at a sense of loyalty, but knows he's guilty and knows he is doomed, and is trying to kind of give him the way out. And in fact, Garment and Sinclair go to see Nixon at San Clemente, where he's spending a lot more time these days. and they speak to Alexander Haig, who's now the chief of staff, said, can we see the president? He's like, yeah, sure. What do you need to see him about? Well, I would have thought that was obvious. You know, they're not there to discuss his tennis game, I would have thought. But they say, we need to advise him it's time to resign. And he said, well, okay, I'll tell him. And the message comes back, no, you can't see him. And he has instructed me to tell you to never, ever, ever bring that up again as a point. Yeah. Now, this is his lawyers are telling him this case is hopeless. There is no way out. You will not survive. And he says, no, it's blind defiance. And it's the hope, really. Something might turn up. You never know. If I can keep this going, because that's all he's down to now, Shane, is time. If I can just keep this going, maybe, who knows, something could come along. He doesn't know what it is, but you never know. And when you're down to just hope, then that's a pretty barren place to be.
Well, and I mean, his lawyers did this on the, you know, we discussed some prior on the back. Well, even Barry Goldwater, right, who is the Republican machine. Okay. Nixon never operated within that framework until he had to. Goldwater is the GOP. And even when he, that, you know, when he turned, because he had so many core, you know, the modern, much bigger part of the party, but the evangelical contingent of the party that were just so, I mean, the foul language and, you know, just how coarse the president, like, this is not how a president's supposed to act. My God, think of the children, you know? And that's when they try to get him to go down. Jaworski, though, like I said, he takes this thing straight to the Supreme Court. And on the same day, so we're right back to where we were last week, folks. I told you it wouldn't take us long, but we had to go back in time a little bit. On the same day that the House Judiciary Committee comes back in to begin voting, well, the open debate and then the vote on the articles of impeachment, the Supreme Court comes back with a ruling, very conveniently timed for any wavering Southern Democrats or even Republicans on the Judiciary Committee. And, well, they find immediately in the 8-8-0 ruling, William Rehnquist recused himself. He'd been, he'd just been appointed to the court by Nixon.
By Nixon, yeah.
And he'd served as a... Well, he was in the Office of Legal Counsel, which is the part of the DOJ that advises the president on the laws as they relate to the White House. So you can see how he might have had a little bit of concern here. You might remember, too, William Rehnquist comes back in 2000 with a vengeance to give George Bush the presidency. So and he made it clear that he never would have voted in favor of Jaworski's argument here throughout his entire career. But they say that the generalized assertion of privilege must yield to the demonstrated specific need for evidence in a pending criminal trial. And on an 8-0 vote, Nixon has to hand over the tapes. And they are done so privately. Some of these tapes, there were members of the Judiciary Committee that really wanted to get their hands on them. It takes about a week for Nixon to comply publicly. I mean, Jaworski, you know, I mean, people knew the, in fact, you know, here's Jaworski on the steps right after.
Especially pleased that it was a unanimous decision, Fred, because in a sense, that doesn't leave any doubt in anybody's mind as to exactly what the law in this situation is. I think we've had a very, very important constitutional decision, not one that, surprised me exactly. I certainly hoped that it would be this way, and I think it'll go down in history as perhaps as an important decision.
So, you know, I mean, this is it, right? And I mean, now the tapes are over there. Nixon, though, still, because he's still, I don't, David, you know, I mean, what you were just talking about there, when they go out to San Clemente, they're trying to tell him, like, don't bring this up, don't talk about this, let's see how long we can drag this out. And they're still fighting John Sirica in district court, well, in Judge John Sirica's courtroom in district court over tapes that the Judiciary Committee are trying to get outside of this. And, you know, so 3 days later, again, I mean, the first day, the first vote on the articles of impeachment, Nixon's lawyer, James St. Clair, is down there still fighting over this shit, saying that, well, we're not going to give up these tapes to the Judiciary Committee because the Supreme Court said we only have to do it in case of a legal dispute, you know, criminal charges.
Would the president have any objection of turning over copies of these tapes that he would turn over to Sirica also to the House Judiciary Committee? Is there any objection?
I have not reviewed the matter with him because it has not been an option that we had understood was available.
What now would be the ground for objection after the Supreme Court ruling vis-a-vis the Jaworski subpoena?
Well, the Supreme Court ruling is extremely limited, very specifically limited to criminal prosecutions. And as I think one of the senators noted in the debates the other evening.
You say it's an option that you didn't understand was available. You certainly understand that the House wants those tapes, don't you?
Well, I understand they're proceeding now as rapidly as they can to debate and final report. And this obviously, in terms of time, is not going to admit of production for that purpose. So that if there's a delay, then of course we'll review the situation.
But why not make them available for the House, the full House, or for the full Senate?
Well, in the first place, they have to be reviewed. They have to be passed on by the court. And as I say, we have not really considered this matter any further at this time.
The House has heard them. And this is still Nixon's lawyer out here playing this dog and pony show for the cameras, right? It means nothing at this point. It means absolutely nothing. And the votes come through on the House, you know, as we talked about in episode 7, three articles of impeachment. And again, just a few days later, Nixon just complies on the last day of July. And, fuck it, just release the tapes to the public.
Yeah. Basically now he realizes that he can keep this going, but no one's buying it. This is the thing, right? Nobody is buying it. Nobody is saying, oh, I'm sure, you know, he's they know. Yeah. And eventually, I think it just, he realizes that, look, we've fought a good fight. You know, we've done our best, but at the end of the day, we're going to have to release these at some point. We might as well do it now. And his lawyers know. His lawyers aren't going to try and talk him out of it because they know that, yeah, he's guilty. He did this. So it's now an argument to see if he can to see if he can survive it. And of course, being Nixon, he still hopes people will hear it in a certain context. What I would say is the context he wants them to hear it in is, I didn't do anything, and people aren't stupid, unfortunately.
No, well, and you know, some of these, again, you know, the House had heard some of the damning tapes, but like I said, I mean, the smoking gun tape comes out in this, which is the conversation between him and Haldeman just a couple days after the break-in. That there's the one where Dean says, what was it, that's the troublesome thing, because Bob is involved in that, John's involved in that, I'm involved in that, Mitchell is involved in that, and that's an obstruction of justice. Like, he fucking, all right, here's everybody who's in this, and this is the crime that we committed. Oh, by the way, I'm the White House lawyer. So
and you know about it because I'm sitting here talking to you right now, and you are talking back to me about it very calmly, and you've just said that we could raise $1 million to pay off these people in hush money, but who would handle it is your big question, rather than it would be wrong. And of course, this tape also means that Haldeman is going to jail for perjury.
Ehrlichman, who, well, given himself up anyway.
Their defense crumbles at this point as well. Yeah. And now it's done. And the president gets a visitation, as Shane mentioned, from the Senate minority leader, Hugh Scott, the senior Republican in the House, in the Senate, sorry. And he gets a visit from Barry Goldwater, who is the party, who's a huge, you know, Nixon was always
scumbag, but yes, he is the GOP.
I don't know so much scumbag as nutter. You know, the man who
qualifies you for both sometimes.
The man who felt he could end the Vietnam War by dropping a nuclear weapon on.
Yes,
I mean, they were just sitting around.
Well, honestly, he thought he could end any war that might be coming in the future by dropping a nuclear
weapon. Well, he's right. I mean, he would have ended all future wars. Yeah, yes. The planet today wouldn't be that. But you and I would never have been born, so I suppose we wouldn't have to worry about it. But he goes up. Now, this guy is as staunchly conservative as you get, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that, and they go up and they meet the president. They say, sir, it's time for you to resign. And the president says, how many votes do I have in the Senate? Now, there's 100, remember, folks. So how many votes do I have in the Senate? Goldwater says, as of this morning, we could guarantee you 10. And yeah. he says, does that include you? And he says, no, sir, it does not. Yeah. So Nixon then phones, actually, we're talking scumbags. He then phones George Wallace, the Democratic governor of Alabama, the racist. Who
you might remember from the last one he went to see on his tour of the South.
Yeah, the proudly, genuinely, and I'm not saying that disingenuously, folks, the proudly racist governor of Alabama, who had been a big factor in electoral politics in the US. He'd ran as a third party candidate in the last two and had about, I think, 10% of the vote, Shane. I mean, he had you know, a big old chunk of.
Well, because again, I mean, he's drawn off the old Southern Democratic vote.
Yeah, so,
I mean, it helped split the Democrats' vote and that until the Democratic Party could fully realign into the vote or the party of we're not okay with the KKK.
Like, yes.
It took a minute.
And that's why this fight. So he phones George Wallace and he says, look, George, are you with me? And he says, no, sir, I am not.
Yeah.
And Nixon puts the phone down and he says to Al Haig, he says, well, Al, there goes the presidency. And it's finally at this point that he accepts the race is done. He speaks to his family and his family get very upset and say, don't resign. But he has made his mind up and he now knows that it has to be done.
Well, and I think, you know, part of the reason this got prolonged in the first place was the influence of Alexander Haig. Yeah. And, quick break. Let's introduce the people of this guy real quick, because he's an important player and somebody, well, in the future of the Republican Party comes up. He's in control here, if you don't know. So we'll come back with Alexander Haig and the last couple days of the Nixon presidency. All right, welcome back into Watergate 50. As always, scroll down, hit the Buy Me a Coffee link. If you like the Crow Pod, help us out. And, of course, with everything David stuff over there in Heart and Hand, just sign up for their Patreon. Just sign up to both. We loved all of you.
Yeah.
You guys have liked the shows. We still got a couple left. We're not done yet. This is not the last half hour, 45 minutes of the Watergate series. We've still got a couple shows left. So don't worry. You can settle in. Get ready. David, Alexander Haig.
Alexander Haig, what a man. Alexander Haig is, we've spoken, there are people in here out of central casting. Alexander Haig is your arrogant bureaucrat military guy from in the loop. He's from the thick of it. He's all of these things. Incredibly self-regarding. To an almost insane point. He was Henry Kissinger's deputy on the NSC. He was a four-star general. Hadn't seen much in the way of combat action, Shane. He was what you might term a political general.
Yeah, he kind of came in that the lull period where we weren't... he probably would have been involved in Cuba had we gone there. But between Korea and, him, you know... I don't want to say Haig's one of these hawks that doesn't actually want to get out and fly, but there were chances for him to spend a little bit more time engaged in Vietnam, and he chose to move in diplomacy instead of active military duty.
Yeah, he's you hear general and you assume, you know, especially in this era, you know, did we think of the generals Westmoreland, etc., that were out there commanding troops? He was not one of those generals. He worked exclusively in the Pentagon. And he was a very skilled as you have to be in the army. That's the thing. People sometimes get a little surprised that the transference. You don't get to become a general if you don't know how to handle political rivals and skillfully negotiate certain challenges. And he did. And he ends up being the chief of staff at a vital period because Nixon isn't functioning. Nixon is drinking too much. He's depressed. Yep. He's only really working on Watergate. He's not focused. And if you're somebody like Haig, who thinks you should be running the country anyway, he describes himself to people around about this time as a sort of prime minister. now, you don't have a prime minister over there, mate.
Is that far off? I think, you know, the public at large, I mean, probably their first introduction to Alexander Haig is, you know, in the time surrounding the Saturday Night Massacre. Because, well, the Yom Kippur War is kicking off, which Nixon used as almost a shield almost every single time he spoke to, like, God, you guys want me worried about Watergate? The Soviets could bomb Israel any second. You know, I mean, almost every single one of his press conferences were like this. But on the night of October 24th, right, 73, Kissinger almost unilaterally, well, I mean, not almost, Kissinger unilaterally decided to move our military, or the entire USA's military, into DEFCON 3, which is
quite tedious.
The
shit.
Highest state, I mean, this is the highest readiness state for the U.S. military under peacetime, mm-hmm. right? He did this again without Nixon. Brezhnev goes, "What in the fuck?" Well, Kissinger, of course, as he often would do, acting out with his remit. Although, as David just said, the reason that Haig is in here, the reason that Kissinger is still in his post, is because Nixon's relatively indisposed with much of the duties of the presidency. Kissinger thought that the Russians could not find out about this move into DEFCON 3 in any kind of reasonable time. They knew within minutes.
Of course they did.
Because they're a huge, massive country with a huge military and intelligence operation. They were like, oh, fuck, look at what they just did. God damn.
It's a crazy thing. I'll say that for Britain back then, and even now, we understand that the Soviets see things before most of the British public do. back then, you know, we were well aware of that. But Haig, and you know, to be fair to Kissinger, somebody had to.
That's right. But you know, Kissinger just does this, and Brezhnev calls and goes, "Oh, what the fuck?" And Kissinger goes to get Nixon at 9:50 at night. Right, 9:50. So it's not late, especially not for a president, especially not for Dick Nixon. This was a guy famously that would work till 2-3 in the morning and get up at 6 ready to go again. But this is Dick Nixon, mired in the middle of Watergate, right around the time of the massacre, with everything that's going on, and he's pissed drunk, mm-hmm. and Kissinger can't get a hold of him, so he finally gets a hold of Haig, and Haig goes, "I'll call you right back. Let me go get him." And he comes back and he said, "Well, you know, the president's retired for the night and I can't wake him." Mm-hmm. And this is where Haig starts to exert his influence. He gets out in front of the media the next day. And this is, you know, what David was saying, that the it's preaching down onto the media. It's the and again, you're going to hear this in here, the willingness to stick to the line that what's most important is the good of the country and the office of the presidency.
I don't think it requires a blueprint for this group here to emphasize that the issue itself had progressively began to polarize our body politic. Lines were clearly being drawn, both within the Congress, within the media, and I think to a large extent within the viewpoint of the American people themselves. There were such tales being bandied about that the recent nomination of a new vice president would be held in hostage to a Supreme Court decision on the tapes issue, and that were the president to defy the court, then we would move with an impeachment against the president, and with no vice president, there would be a turnover of the government to a party which did not win November's election.
I mean, this guy is just checking every box that Dick Nixon could want out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just rambling bullshit.
Oh, no, yeah, it's just complete rhetorical party fucking nonsense. Complete, but
it doesn't play badly. Yeah, it doesn't play badly for him in the media, but he's very, he is effectively running the White House at this point.
Well, and this is, you know, whereas Bob Haldeman and Ehrlichman, generally had the best interests of Nixon and therefore the best interests of the country at heart.
As they perceived them. No.
Yes. You know, right. We would, correct. No, not like some neutral level. No, but
as they perceived them to be, I would agree with that.
Whereas, look, you know, Alexander Haig out the back of this, just to, no shock, you guys. By December of 1974, is the Supreme Commander of NATO. So he turned out okay off the back of the job that he does here over the last months and weeks in Nixon's presidency. It's kind of weird, you know, when you walk the guy out the door and leave it open for the next guy, the kind of jobs that you can get off the back of that. It's weird.
Ends up being Reagan's Secretary of State. I mean, this is a guy who does pretty well out of the whole situation. Unsuccessful run for the Republican nomination in 1988.
Much to Homer Simpson's chagrin.
He had the backing of one Homer Simpson, who has been... There's a foul photo of Homer wearing a Haig for 88 t-shirt. But then we, of course, get the Ford issue when Gerald Ford, Alexander Haig asked for a meeting with him. Now, folks, there is a lot of debate about what happened at this meeting. People agree that no deal was struck at this meeting, and I agree with them. I do not believe that either of them were stupid enough that Haig comes right out and says Nixon says he'll resign if you give him a pardon. There are a lot of ways, though, that you can make something clear to someone without necessarily saying those words. Yeah. And to the point where after this meeting, where Haig goes through all the things that can happen, including some of the ridiculous ones, like, you know, the president can refuse and we'll turn the troops on, you know, the Senate and things like that. You know, things that won't happen. But he goes through literally every possible one. And Ford, who is now preparing himself to become president. And you can say that, you know, if you're Haig, you can say, but one thing we should have all learned throughout this period is things that you say, and they can come back later and be held. So that they're having to be very careful and talk. But he goes back and he speaks to Robert Butterworth, who's one of his advisors. And he says, I've just a meeting with Haig. And he said, you've done fucking what? and he said, well, I just, you know, Al asked to see me. He's like, are you fucking mad? You know how that's going to look? And he makes him call up to have on the record, he makes him call Haig and say, I want this on the record officially. We will release this to the press that nothing was spoken about in terms of any deal. And Haig says, no, you're absolutely correct. We did not speak. And nothing says to me, Shane, that they did not have a deal, that the fact that they had to get together and say immediately afterwards, as soon as somebody realized how it looked. But Ford goes home, says to Betty, his wife, wonderful woman, done a lot for addiction, and she says, well, and he said, yep, and they went to the local church and prayed because they realized the shit storm that was about to come down.
As David said, Nixon talks to his wife and kids there on, say, August 7th, the night of August 7th. There's a famous picture of them in the White House, like in their kitchen, you know, in the residence, in their little kitchen that they have there. And, you know, tells them, you know, it's time. Comes out August 8th, and I think he really, 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 for the last time, wanted to command television.
I agree.
But it did leak during the day, obviously, because at this point, look, you got people in the White House know, and they need to set themselves up for the rest of their careers, you know? So you can't blame this information for getting out, but Nixon still does. I mean, commands it well. He practiced a speech five or six times before then, because what the fuck else do you have to do that day, you know? That's pretty much it. And so, in a evening address to the goddamn near everybody in the United States, Richard Nixon,
and the rest of the world, it was carried live in the UK, even though everywhere. Normally British TV at that time would literally shut down. People my age even will remember.
I think this would have been 1 a.m.
UK, 1 a.m. Special late night programming in the UK. I mean, that it was carried live to an audience that I think is almost incalculable.
Yeah. So,
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office. For more than a quarter of a century in public life, I have shared in the turbulent history of this era. I have fought for what I believed in. I have tried, to the best of my ability, to discharge those duties and meet those responsibilities that were entrusted to me. Sometimes I have succeeded, and sometimes I have failed.
The Richard Nixon on television that night is not the Richard Nixon at the White House the next day. And, you know, look,
that's classic Nixonian.
No, it's perfect.
I need to speak. You know, I'm about to resign for this terrible thing that I have did and lied about for the last 2 years and put the country.
So I need 25 minutes on television.
So
right
I need
now.
A half an hour on TV, all networks. And secondly, I'm not doing this, you know, for my own good. Gets in. This is the good of the nation. I've got to think of the good of the nation. One thing he's totally correct on, though, is he says, you know, for 25 years, Richard Nixon is, along with probably FDR and maybe Wilson, the most significant, and Reagan. I'll give Reagan too, actually, because of the Cold War. Sorry, mate, but it's true. But, you know, even because Reagan, outwith his presidency, although there's a long-standing impact on domestic, in terms of the most significant American political figures, Nixon dwarfs Kennedy, for example. You know, Kennedy's...
we've had 6 Ronald Reagans for president ever since Reagan was elected president.
So. Kennedy's mythology is huge, for example, right? Yeah. Eisenhower, a great man in any definition of a great
man.
Didn't
do a lot.
No, but Nixon, he was, you know, the vice president. He was president. And there's just so much of his stamp on this vital, incredible period in American world history.
This is a man who actually served in World War II, importantly. Again, the vice president goes back, is in the House, comes back, runs for president again, comes back, runs for president again. You know, you had 30 years of Dick Nixon being there at critical junctures of the entire American existence.
Exactly. And for me,
then
you know,
wake up, you know, August 9th. And
I honestly think the only two comparable would be FDR and Wilson in that
space. Certainly in the modern era, yeah. You know,
I mean, obviously, yeah. If you go back to
Lincoln and Grant.
Purely 20th century, I would definitely. He's top five, regardless of.
Well, it actually, you know, one he mentions, so he comes in the next morning, and he wants to talk to all of his staff, and he wants to talk to his family and everybody in the White House. And again, I mean, this is a different Dick Nixon, as you're about to hear. But he tells, you know, again, I mean, he's got notes. He's got a speech. He's not ill-prepared. But he's also just rambling because he doesn't know what to do. And you can hear it in his voice. You know? Yeah, I mean,
I actually think he's cut adrift here. Yeah,
you know?
I actually think that you're going to play it and we're going to discuss it afterwards. I'll let the listener say it and I'll tell you what I think afterwards. But go with the clip first.
Yeah. So here is, another one of the most controversial, most important, I don't want to say controversial, but most important presidents is who he's talking about here, Mr. Teddy Roosevelt.
You are here to say goodbye to us. And we don't have a good word for it in English. The best is au revoir. We'll see you again. Had a little quote in a speech last night from T.R. As you know, I kind of like to read books. I'm not educated, but I do read books. And there's another one I found as I was reading my last night in the White House. And this quote is about a young man. He was a young lawyer in New York. He'd married a beautiful girl. And they had a lovely daughter. And then suddenly, she died. And this is what he wrote. This was in his diary. He said, "She was beautiful in face and form, and lovelier still in spirit. As a flower she grew, and as a fair young flower she died. And when my heart's dearest died, the light went from my life forever." That was T.R. in his 20s. He thought the life had gone from his life forever, but he went on. And he not only became president, but as an ex-president, he served his country, always in the arena, tempestuous, strong, sometimes wrong, sometimes right. But he was a man.
He was a man, David.
He was a man. And yeah, you hear, I mean, clearly emotional. You hear that he's just rambling. And it's this curious mix of self-pity.
I mean, he's comparing the loss of a daughter to having to leave the White House.
Yeah, exactly. But the wife and daughter, it was the same night.
He lost
his wife and his right. daughter died. And again, you know, you get in, I'm not educated, you know, yes, you are. and, you know, but it's that still, you've got the self-pity, you've got the sense of, everybody's out to get me. It's a sin for me. But then you get that beautiful part where he speaks about, you know, hating others. And finally, he gets it. Too late. And I think that there's something fittingly tragic about this is when he says that, you know, give your best. Don't hate others. Others may hate you, but don't hate them back, because when you do, you destroy yourself. And you go, well, finally, there you go, at last. Yeah. And it is very beautiful, and it's always a moment that gives me goosebumps when I watch it, because right then, finally, and this man is now in his 60s, and this man has had an incredible career, and he hasn't had this insight until it's too late.
Yeah, he's 2 hours from walking out of the job.
He's finally given that insight. Finally, he's been allowed, but it's taken him to lose. I mean,
where he worked his whole life for.
And something that is still unsurpassed. It's never been done. It's never had. No president has. And look, you know, Carter lost an election. Trump lost an election. People lose elections. That shit happens. But only one man in history has had the job and been taken and forced to leave it. And that's him. And never mind being the first, he could still well be. We could be back here. Well, you and I are unlikely to be. You never know. Technological breakthroughs.
Nah, look, 10 years, man. That's about.
Probably, yeah.
But if we get tomorrow, we're okay.
Yeah, we take it as a score draw, definitely. Exactly. A good solid away point. But if we're about 100 years, or the listeners are, or anyone is listening to this, then it probably won't have happened by then either. No. And this is an insight that was blindingly obvious to almost everybody, that here is this man who has exactly done what he said. He hated others because they hated him. And, you know, we'll do a kind of roundup show, and we'll talk about Nixon the person. And we spoke a bit about it in the first episode. But this is the contradictions. And, you know, here's this guy, this amazing CV, and it is. You know, Matt, you know, it's an amazing CV, 100%. Amazing achievements, loving wife, loving family. By any possible definition of success in life.
I mean, friends willing to go to jail for him.
Yes, you know, owns properties the size of Kentucky, and by any definition, and none of it was ever enough. And in fact, that darkness, that internal darkness, is such that it consumes him, and only after it's consumed him does he finally get that glimpse of understanding. And to be honest, Shane, I don't think it could have been any more fitting. That is sort of how it had to end for him. In a way that we've spoken about this play enough, like a movie script, you know, he could have went off being dragged, kicking and screaming, and it wouldn't have been as fitting as this. His final chat with the staff, many of whom are in tears and breaking down. And then he goes out and he gets to give the last defiant V for victory sign.
Well, here, there's one more thing in the speech here I did want to play. And by all means, folks, like everything else that we've talked about in this show, go watch it. Because it's about a half hour. I'm not going to play the whole goddamn thing. But, you know, as David said, he's coming to these realizations and he's thinking about his life and himself as a person and the lessons that maybe he should have taken on board a couple of years prior. And he comes on to his mother, and it's...
Nobody will ever write a book probably about my mother. Well, I guess all of you would say this about your mother. My mother was a saint. And I think of her, two boys dying of tuberculosis, nursing four others in order that she could take care of my older brother for 3 years in Arizona, and seeing each of them die. And when they died, it was like one of her own. Yes, she will have no books written about her. But she was a saint.
And like David said, I think right there, he's having to go through, like, you can see it in him. What would my mom think about me right now?
That's exactly it.
And he's having to process all this. And then, as David said, he goes in and he signs the letter to Henry Kissinger to say, I'm out. And him and Gerald Ford walk out onto the main lawn of the White House. And he has his last moment here as broadcast by CBS.
This is the south side of the White House, the side that faces the Washington Monument, Turning Basin, and the Lincoln Memorial. They are emerging from the so-called diplomatic entrance downstairs.
There is the man who will be president in another couple of hours, Gerald Ford and his wife, Betty Ford.
Vice President Ford this morning, as he left his home to come here for this occasion, said it was indeed one of the saddest incidents that he's ever seen. And there is the president waving goodbye, and you hear the applause.
President Nixon peering out from behind the bullet-resistant glass, Vice President and Mrs. Ford standing just to the left of Mr. and Mrs. Cox, and just in front of that old magnolia tree that was planted by Andrew Jackson. President Nixon's helicopter going over the fountains of the White House South Lawn, over the back black fence, high over the ellipse. Toward the base of the Washington Monument.
President Dan is getting his last look now as he peers back from that seat in the helicopter.
What a scene
of the
there,
White Wilson. House as President of the United States. This will be the last look. By the time he comes back to this point, if indeed history decrees that he does at any point, he will, of course, no longer be the president.
And that was it.
And that was it. And America now had a new president. And we'll get into that more next week because the story isn't done yet.
No.
The story isn't done. What was going to happen to him? What was going to... Yeah. Yes, he wasn't the president, but there was still all these criminal charges, criminal act.
Well, and that's... I mean, I do love, you know, David, you were saying there right before, but that last... His last moment on the steps, you know, that last Nixonian moment in front of the cameras there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's perfect. You know, it's the defiance. It's the, you know, I'm on TV, which, you know, was always something that he loved. And it is. It's exactly. It's all the things that we said. And it's, you know, a V sign to his critics. It's going out on his shield. It's everything about the guy that, yes, that morning is everything about the guy that fascinates us, because it's got all of the things. It's got defiance, it's got self-pity, it's got pride, it's got insecurity, it's got rambling.
You can even see it, like, in his smile when he throws at the visa. He's like, should they be doing it? Ah, fuck it, I'm doing
fuck it. That's exactly it. It's like, you know, fuck the lot of you. I'm doing it.
Took me out of my fucking house.
But that's the man who half an hour before had been almost in tears and rambling about his mum being a... You know, there's so much going on about Nixon. He is just this fascinating cornucopia of just about... And they shouldn't live in the same person. That's the thing about Nixon. These are things... You cannot be as supremely confident and as debilitatingly lacking in self-confidence as he is at the same time. And yet he is. And it's this constant battle. Richard Nixon is just a walking battle between his inner emotions. And he was that his whole life.
What was it? It came in his memoirs later, but, you know, he'd written in his journal that night. As the helicopter moved on toward the Andrews Air Force Base, I found myself thinking not of the past, but of the future. What could I do now? You know, and I got on the plane and then went home to San Clemente. And then, you know, as David said, look, there's still a lot to figure out here. Ford is president, but as Jaworski had said, despite... Well, apparently everybody on the grand jury, all 19 people on the grand jury sitting on the evidence against Dick Nixon that thought he should be indicted while he was still president, as we find out after Jaworski's passing in 1982, he's not the sitting president anymore, and he has committed a lot of crimes, just a laundry list of fucking crimes, and obviously Nixon knows, he's a lawyer, and he knows how bad this might be, but Gerald Ford is there. And, well, as David said, look, next week we get to come back, we get to wrap, but put a little bow tie on everything, I think. Not only, you know, the final decision around what should happen to Dick Nixon, but also I think, you know, we'll probably spend a little bit of time looking at, the Frost interview and the interviews later in life and some of the other people too. Like I said, I think a lot of what John Ehrlichman had to say after the fact was pretty insightful to how I think most of the people in that White House were thinking about things at the time and how they come to think of them later.
Yeah, agreed.
Watergate 50, that's episode 8. I said that's, I don't know. I mean, if all you wanted to do was get to the point where Nixon's gone, I guess, you know, you're out. But
Oh, no. They'll want to know what happens next.
Yes.
There's still plenty to come.
No, there's... and look, I said we would get to this point. We have gotten to this point. So, again, if you go down the show notes, you like everything that we're doing, hit the Buy Me a Coffee link. That helps out the Crow Pod with David. Of course, you go to their Patreon. But also in the show notes this week, there will be a link to effectively leave us a voicemail. It goes through the Crow Pod's Anchor website. Mm-hmm. You just click it. You can leave us a question. Fancy. We're still, you know, me and David got to talk. We still might do a live show or something of that sort. But for now, all you got to do, like I said, scroll down to the show notes. Wherever you're listening to this right now, there's a link there. They'll go to the Crow Pods Anchor. It's our hosting platform thing, whatever. You click on that, you can leave us what is effectively a voicemail. Leave us your name or if you got a Twitter handle, whatever, so we know who you are, or fuck, even your follow fucking sign up if you got that. That way we can reach out to your families and tell them what a strange person you are for leaving us messages in the middle of the night. But no, next week's the last one that we're going to go with just us. So like I said, I mean, there's the pardon of Nixon. There is the, well, the final 20 years of Nixon's life. I mean, he's still, to the day he died, say he was innocent. To the day he died, he fought to keep his papers and tapes and recordings. These court cases weren't even done. They were decided after his death, many of them. I mean, he spent the last quarter year or the last quarter century. You know, he talks about in that farewell speech that I spent a quarter century in the middle of the most, consequential decisions of this time in history. But he spends the last quarter century of his life fighting literally every single day to keep any of that decision-making private. It consumes him, and the Watergate never goes away for him.
No, final release of tapes isn't until 2011.
Yeah. Well, and again, we talked about, look, there's, was it 2,200, 2,500 hours of tapes somewhere around there? But there's only about 300 or 400 of them out there. We've got all the transcripts and everything, or at least what you can make out. But as far as the audio goes, again, the quality's poor, and decisions have been made, not because you can't make out a lot of this shit. But I can't. It's the thing. Well, David, I mean, you've said it repeatedly. It's why we find Nixon so entertaining or so engaging all this time later, that God damn it. I mean, you're done. It's over. And yet he is going to spend literally every day of the rest of his life fighting Watergate until the day he dies.
The rest of his life telling the story the way he believes it should be told.
Yep.
And that's that. Not telling the truth. You'll note I very expressly didn't say that. And not even his truth, because it wasn't that. He spends the rest of his life fighting to tell a story, version of Watergate. But there's some cold shit ahead next week as well for how he spoke to some of his ex-employees who'd gone to jail for him. Nick, don't miss next week. There's a lot of very interesting stuff ahead.
By God, 69 former government officials end up indicted or charged throughout this, and 48 being found guilty. And, of course, many of them are his top. I mean, again, we're talking about Mitchell, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, LaRue, Magruder, Kleindienst, whoever. I mean, his fucking people, right? And yes, as David says, it's not, it's not done. I mean, there's still tea being spilled around the Nixon White House. So back for that next week, episode 9. Again, like I said, scroll down in the show notes to either help us out, or if you want to, if you got a question, if you think we haven't talked about something, if you think that there's something that you want to hear more on, leave us a note there. Like I said, you call, you hit the little button, you leave us a voicemail, just leave your name and what your question is, and we will definitely come back and answer those in episode 10, if not do a live show as well. So that's it. David, of course, you can find on Twitter for Nixon shit at David A. Edgar 23. If you want to talk to him about Rangers, you know where to find him on Ibrox Rocks. Thanks again, David.
A pleasure as always, mate.
And me, of course, you can always find at Avoid. We'll be back sometime here soon for episode 9, the day after tomorrow, I guess. But write that down. That's going to be...
Yeah, it's good to like that. Yeah, day after tomorrow.
All right, guys. Thank you all. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
It is just too tricky for a chump like me to use. Oh, you.
You take that subcommittee serious, boy.
I'm serious.
You just might get a seizure from the evening news.